This is the Nietzsche Podcast. What is the meaning of science for life? This question is of great importance in the early period of Nietzsche's writing. And in some sense, we could say that his early period is preoccupied with understanding the relationships between a number of domains of human thought or activity: art, culture, the state, philosophy, and of course, science. Nietzsche is not so much concerned at this time with, say, the questions of anthropological origins, nor is his goal to formulate precise definitions exactly. These such scholarly pursuits might be involved, of course, but for Nietzsche, they're subordinated to the real question: what purpose do each of these have for life? Meaning, how does art foster human life, or does it, in some cases, hamper it? Nietzsche asks this question about history in his essay On the Use and Abuse of History for Life. The question, in some sense, is contained in the title there. Or in Nietzsche's first book, The Birth of Tragedy, he asks, what are the conditions in which art fosters life? What are the conditions in which life is hindered by art? Furthermore, how can one of these domains of human thought or activity affect the others? Is there, for instance, a hostile relationship between the state and culture? He grapples with this question in the essay The Greek State. Or the question that Nietzsche puts to himself when he's examining the philosophers of the tragic age of the Greeks: when is philosophy a physician to culture, or the philosopher a physician to culture? And when is philosophy a detriment to culture? In short, throughout his early period, we see Nietzsche continually shift from domain to domain, asking, what relationship do these have to one another? What is their purpose to us as living beings? And are there ways in which the relationships between these domains can be hostile or harmonious, productive or unproductive, between culture and the state, or between science and art, or, in the fragment we're going to consider today, between science and wisdom? And this is, if I may say so myself, a somewhat curious fragment written by Nietzsche in the year 1875, which is a little while after he'd written Birth of Tragedy and Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks, and he'd already written the first three of his untimely meditations by this point. This fragment is called Science and Wisdom in Battle. And in it, Nietzsche is grappling with the implications of his study of the Pre-Platonics and his study of the course of Greek culture in general. This fragment, it's very much in the form of a note. He's writing to himself here, working through his own thoughts. It reads like the sort of scaffolding on which he might build a future work, not as if it was ever intended to be the kind of thing that would be published as a work. Much of what he says here is only roughly sketched out. He's trying to make sense of the meaning of all that he knows about the Greeks, what the history of the Greek culture, their philosophy, their art, their science can tell us that is relevant to human life right now. So Nietzsche writes in this fragment, quote, "So much depends on the development of the Greek culture, since our whole Occidental world got its impulses from it. Fate wanted that the younger and degenerated Greekism showed the most historical strength. The older Greekism has always been judged wrongly. The younger one must be known exactly in order to distinguish it from the older one. There are still many possibilities that have not been discovered yet, because the Greeks did not discover them. Others have been discovered by the Greeks and later covered up again. These philosophers proved the dangers of the Greek culture." End quote. So before we dive further into this fragment, I want to say a few words about Nietzsche's first book, The Birth of Tragedy, as a point of comparison here for the background context of science and wisdom in battle. I'd also recommend that if you haven't done so, to listen to the episodes on philosophy in the tragic age of the Greeks, because a familiarity with that essay, I would say, is more or less required in order to comprehend science and wisdom in battle. And it'll just be easier if you have a basic knowledge of the figures that are discussed in that work. Birth of Tragedy has as its undercurrent this underlying conflict between science and art. Nietzsche says in his 1886 preface to Birth of Tragedy that he was the first one to raise what he calls the problem of science, and this problem arrives on the scene in the form of Socrates, the mystagogue of science. Perhaps the most striking thing about Socrates is that he places himself in opposition to art. It's Nietzsche's examination of that aspect of Socrates that constitutes one of the great insights of the Birth of Tragedy. That element of Socrates, it was always there in the dialogues of Plato, but Nietzsche finds a particular significance in this anti-artistic tendency, insofar as Socrates stands for a totalizing moral, logical approach to life. Poets are to be expelled from his ideal republic. Socrates considers the orators and the rhapsodes to be unvirtuous people, or at least they're not the kind of people that should be lauded. You know, they're simply possessed by an artistic mimesis, and they can be highly dangerous to the social order on that account. And so Nietzsche positions Socrates as an enemy of Greek tragedy, and he suggests it was the influence of Socratism on drama that pushed the zeitgeist toward, eventually, comedy. Tragedy depicted a world in which there was no inherent moral order, in which the good, the noble man, did not win in the end, but he meets his downfall. The New Attic Comedy, on the other hand, confined the individual to a limited sphere of solvable problems, as Nietzsche puts it. So, Socrates is an optimist. He is a moralist. He has a theory of the ideal moral character, of the ideal society, of the ideal life. And so Nietzsche characterizes the story of Greek civilization as a war of the theoretic, the Socratic, logical, moral point of view, against the tragic, the fatalistic worldview. In Birth of Tragedy, the tragic culture is defined as essentially an artistic culture. In this older Greekism, as Nietzsche puts it, the culture that Socrates attacked, the poets and playwrights are actually regarded as the true educators of the spirit. Nietzsche describes dramatic tragedy as the central cultural lodestone. The forces of Apollo, or the principle of individuation, and Dionysus, or the force of dissolution, are continually discharged within this art form. And in fact, the most famous line in all of the book is when Nietzsche writes that it's only as an aesthetic phenomenon that life can be eternally justified. That is definitive of his view of Hellenic Greece. And that's the way in which Birth of Tragedy is a kind of dramatization of this war between science and art. The artistic culture of the older Greekism that celebrated passions, that allowed for irrationality, against the new totalizing scientific worldview of Socrates that necessarily suppresses art and subordinates passion to the rational and to the ethical. The problem of science, therefore, when it's more fully articulated, is this. Does science always stand in such a hostile relationship to art? And if it does, could this tension be productive? Is there a way that art and science can be opposed and yet still benefit one another? Nietzsche believes that there can be, and that in fact there must be, because these relations of mutual tension are the only way that such productivity or creativity can exist. We could say that's the theory of the case behind Nietzsche's ultimate conclusions as regards these relationships of tension between different domains of human thought or activity. To disturb that tension is to threaten that creativity created by it. The tension, in fact, must be heightened and not slackened. Nietzsche's way of thinking about this is undoubtedly influenced by the cultural concept of the ancient Greeks of the Aegon, their notion of friendship that goes along with that, that the friend is simultaneously a rival and one's enemies are simultaneously great benefactors. Dionysus and Apollo are both irreconcilable enemies and mutually incomprehensible to one another, but in this relationship, they also mutually enhance one another. And so too with art and science. In a productive state of tension, they heighten and enhance one another, which is why Nietzsche says in Birth of Tragedy that even the Socratic attack on art, quote, again and again necessitates a regeneration of art, end quote. But Socratism nevertheless represents a great danger to Athenian society. It does so in that it attempts to disturb that balance and unbend the bowstring, so to speak. Socrates recognizes only the Apollinean, the self-creating, boundary-drawing, representational, artistic faculty that's correlated with individuation. Socrates does not recognize the Dionysian, the natural, passionate, boundary-destroying force of dissolution. And it is not that standing for the Apollinean is bad in Nietzsche's eyes, nor is it that the Dionysian ought to have won and overrun and destroyed Apollo. In fact, Nietzsche writes in multiple passages in Birth of Tragedy that wherever the Dionysian was unrestrained in ancient cultures, it completely overwhelmed the society and led to their downfall. It is simply that Nietzsche sees a similar danger if the Apollinean tendency, the tendency encapsulated best in the dictate, know thyself, is allowed to become all-powerful. If the tension between self-knowledge and self-forgetting is put to an end, then the productivity will end. Greek culture will cease to be natural, vital, and creative. It will instead enter a period in which they become passive, theoretical, catalogers of past cultural achievement. That's what happens if the Apollinean is allowed to win, so to speak. And that is, in Nietzsche's estimation, exactly what happened. Moreover, this cultural development does not simply end with the downfall of Greece, but in some sense continues throughout the entire history of European culture. As Nietzsche says in the part of that fragment that we quoted earlier, we received all of our impulses from the Greeks. So Nietzsche writes in Birth of Tragedy 15, quote, "He who once makes intelligible to himself how, after the death of Socrates, the mystagogue of science, one philosophical school succeeds another, like wave upon wave, how an entirely unforeshadowed universal development of the thirst for knowledge in the widest compass of the cultured world, and as the specific task for everyone highly gifted, led science on to the high sea from which since then it has never again been able to be completely ousted. How through the universality of this movement, a common net of thought was first stretched over the entire globe, with prospects, moreover, of conformity to law in an entire solar system. He who realizes all this, together with the amazingly high pyramid of our present-day knowledge, cannot fail to see in Socrates the turning point and vortex of so-called universal history," end quote. But it is telling what Nietzsche imagines as his counterfactual to this. He imagines not the ascendance of the totalizing artistic impulse, the Dionysian overwhelming society, but imagines the possibility of an artistic Socrates. He says that in view of Socrates' life and character, it prompts us to ask the question, quote, whether there is necessarily only an antipodal relation between Socratism and art, end quote. So is the totalizing scientific impulse of Socrates always going to overwhelm and destroy art, or is there another possibility of holding science and art in this state of tension, even heightening the tension, but not seeking to resolve it by overrunning and destroying one or the other, or banishing or emasculating one or the other? Is the birth of an artistic Socrates something that must be regarded as essentially contradictory, or is an artistic Socrates possible? Again, returning to Birth of Tragedy 15, quoting here further in an abridged form, quote, But now science, spurred on by its powerful illusions, hastens irresistibly to its limits, on which its optimism, hidden in the essence of logic, is wrecked. The noble and gifted man inevitably comes into contact with those extreme points of the periphery where he stares at the inexplicable, when he here sees to his dismay how logic coils round itself at these limits and finally bites its own tail. Then the new form of perception discloses itself, namely tragic perception, which, in order even to be endured, requires art as a safeguard and remedy. If, with eyes strengthened and refreshed at the sight of the Greeks, we look upon the highest spheres of the world that surrounds us, we behold the avidity of the insatiate optimistic knowledge, of which Socrates is the typical representative, transformed into tragic resignation and the need of art. While, to be sure, this same avidity in its lower stages has to exhibit itself as antagonistic to art and must especially have an inward detestation of the Dionysio-tragic art, as was exemplified in the opposition of Socratism to the Aeschylean tragedy. Here, then, with agitated spirit, we knock at the gates of the present and the future. Will that transforming lead to ever new configurations of genius, and especially of the music-practicing Socrates? End quote. And I think it's important to note Nietzsche leaves off on a question mark there. What is significant for our purposes in this passage is noticing those relations of tension, the way in which Nietzsche is thinking through the possibilities through a series of questions. He asks how science can be placed in a healthy relation to art. And healthy does not mean free of conflict, but the opposite. The image of this healthy opposition is not the rejection of Socrates and all that he represents, but a Socrates that practices music. After perceiving the limits of the rational, theoretical, optimistic approach to the world, at the end of optimism is the perception of the tragic, when we realize that logic cannot solve what we might call the deepest, most existential problems of the human condition. Where then do we have recourse? It's at those limits of the uses of science that we return to art and begin to look for aesthetic justifications for life. And so it might be possible at just such a limit where the scientific modern man finds himself beyond the extremities of science and then drawn to the sphere of art, that what Nietzsche calls new configurations of genius might arise. And Nietzsche wonders in this passage if such a restored tension between science and art could perhaps be the path forward for the modern mind, or whether it will simply be torn to shreds, quote, by the restlessly barbaric activity and whirl which is called the present day, end quote. So with that bit of background, that little look into part of Birth of Tragedy to define the territory, so to speak, we're now going to consider the fragment, Science and Wisdom in Battle. And I'd like to begin by looking at a paragraph near the end of the fragment, actually, that I'm going to quote from at length. But it's worth going over the whole thing because it most clearly conveys Nietzsche's project of understanding relationships of tension, and it powerfully suggests that his philosophical project is to set them into productive tension. And once again, he anchors this examination in his desire to make this tension beneficial to human life, that's the point of all of this. And so Nietzsche writes, quote, "There comes an hour for everyone when he asks with astonishment before himself, how does one live? An hour when he begins to understand that he possesses a resourcefulness of the same kind that he admires in the plant, that twists and climbs and at last forces itself a little light and a little soil and thus creates its own share of joy in an inhospitable soil. In the descriptions which one makes of his life, there is always such a point where one marvels how here the plant can still live and how it still goes on with an unshakable bravery. Now, there are lives where the difficulties have grown into enormity, those of the thinkers. And here, where something of it is told, one must listen attentively, for here one hears something of the possibilities for life, of which only to hear brings happiness and strength, and pours down light on the lives of those in later ages. Here everything is so inventive, prudent, daring, desperate, and full of hope, such as the voyages of the greatest circumnavigators of the world, and also indeed something of the same kind, circumnavigations of the remotest and most dangerous areas of life. The astonishing thing in such courses of life lies in the fact that two hostile drives, pushing in different directions, are here forced to walk, as it were, under one yoke. The one that wants knowledge must again and again leave the ground on which man lives and venture into the unknown. And the drive that wants life must again and again grope its way to a roughly safe place on which to stand. We are reminded of James Cook, who had to grope his way through a chain of cliffs, sinker in hand, for 3 months, and whose dangers often increased to such an extent that he even gladly sought shelter again in a situation which he had shortly before considered one of the most dangerous. That struggle between life and cognition will be all the greater, that going under a yoke all the stranger, the more powerful both urges are. End quote. And Nietzsche was fond of describing such intellectual adventures by referring to the voyages of real-life explorers. As we see from numerous references to Columbus when Nietzsche was staying in Genoa. From there, Columbus launched his voyage to the New World. And here, he refers to the expeditions of Captain James Cook, a man who explored Australia and New Zealand. Danger is described, but as a kind of enticement, danger as an adventure, as a powerful thing that enhances the explorer, makes him larger than life. But most important here is Nietzsche's assertion that in the great explorers of the psyche, just as in the great explorers of the natural world, two mutually hostile drives who wish to push in two directions walk under one yoke. They're bound together, forced to walk together. So here Nietzsche sets cognition against life, and he means here the rational intellectual cognition, the scientific spirit, which seeks particular empirical knowledge. Nietzsche writes that, quote, "Science fathoms the course of nature, but can never command man. Inclination, love, desire, unwillingness, exaltation, exhaustion, science does not know all this. That what man lives and experiences, he must interpret himself in some way, thereby estimate." End quote. The activity of interpreting one's life, one's experiences, is, roughly speaking, what Nietzsche here calls wisdom. Wisdom is what drives us in this project of making estimations of life. Estimations based on inclination, love, desire, aversion, all of that irrational, instinctive human stuff that science cannot draw upon. As Nietzsche would later write in Beyond Good and Evil, to judge is to be unjust. To make a valuation is in some sense to have simply a physiological demand for a certain way of life. And so these sorts of claims, or these sorts of judgments rather, cannot really be evaluated by science. All the same, one may still find the meaning of both of these terms, or rather the distinction Nietzsche's making between these terms, science and wisdom, somewhat vague or maybe open to interpretation. So Nietzsche helpfully clarifies near the beginning of this passage exactly what he means by both terms. He begins this fragment by exploring how it is that man finds a need for science, and he writes, quote, "Science, before it is habit and instinct, arises, 1. If the gods are not thought well, great advantage to recognize anything as solid. 2. Egoism drives the individual to seek his benefit through science and certain pursuits, e.g. navigation. 3. Something for distinguished people who have leisure, curiosity. 4. In the wild to and fro of popular opinion, the individual wants a firmer foundation. How does this drive to science differ from the drive to learn and accept anything at all? only by the lesser degree of egoism, or the further tension of the same. First, a losing oneself in things. Secondly, a selfishness extended beyond the individual. End quote. Okay, so Nietzsche is concerned with the question of why we would become scientific before it is habit and instinct. In other words, to put ourselves into the mindset of a society which is not yet overtaken by this totalizing scientific outlook that's fostered by Socrates. Let us take ourselves back to a mindset in which the value of science is not yet proven, not yet taken for granted. Why become scientific? One reason, if the gods are not thought well, so if the religion of the society has become questionable, then it becomes to one's great advantage to find some solid metaphysical ground to stand on. It is in that culture in which myths are no longer motivating that we find ourselves set before the burning question, what exists and why? A second reason, the personal advantage granted by the sciences. Nietzsche mentions navigation. Learning to use the stars to set your course gives a definite advantage to the sailor. Thirdly, scientific thought might arise among the leisurely class. Somebody who makes a foray into the investigation of the natural world will, in this pre-modern age, usually be an individual of means, we should say, who needs new domains of activity for their recreation beyond those of quotidian survival. And the fourth and final reason Nietzsche gives, this divergent multitude of viewpoints held by the many. This drives the individual to seek a firmer foundation for their knowledge because when they look out into the public sphere, they don't perceive a consensus but a continuous quarrel. So they try to then know for themselves truths about nature to find a firm ground to stand on. In so many words, ever since ancient times, it's been easy to notice that in the public sphere, we simply don't all agree, even about the most basic facts. And who are you going to outsource your authority to when it comes to determining the facts of the natural world? And this observation is what turns us away from seeking that truth in opinion at all, and turns one towards looking for that truth in the form of concrete facts. So another interesting thing about the passage we just read is that Nietzsche recognizes there's this implicit tension between science, which is that pursuit of concrete truths, and egoism, the pursuit of personal advantage. The desire to simply learn new skills or acquire new technical knowledge need not indicate a scientific spirit just by that token alone, since these are purely egoistic desires for learning. The scientific spirit only truly emerges after the fact of somebody having that initial impetus for science, one of which is egoism, personal advantage, the personal advantage of the navigator, right? The scientific spirit only emerges after the fact by one overcoming egoism, either by losing oneself in their study of the natural world, or heightening the tension of science and egoism by extending one's self-interest beyond that individual advantage. For some examples of this that I could come up with, an example of scientific thinking overcoming egoism I think can be seen in the writing of Montaigne when he suggests that, quote, study and contemplation draw our soul out of us to some extent and keep it busy outside the body, end quote. And then on the other hand, we could interpret, say, the example of Spinoza as someone in whom the egoism is heightened by the scientific drive, insofar as Spinoza's view of nature, and in fact all individuals within nature, is that they're all modes of the same substance, which is God. That by conflating all of nature, all of existence, with my own self-existence, in a way I extend my egoism beyond that individual existence. Next, Nietzsche defines wisdom. Quote, wisdom shows itself, one, in the illogical generalizing and flying to the ultimate goal. Two, in the relation of these results to life. Three, and the unconditional importance one attaches to one's soul, one thing is necessary. End quote. This passage on wisdom is much shorter and I would say more enigmatic, and it requires a lot more interpretive work. But we can see the unmistakable similarity in what Nietzsche calls wisdom to the way he talks about the pre-Platonic philosophers, especially in Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks. These men that he said proceeded by great leaps and flights of fancy, and he compares that, or contrasts it rather, with the theoretical style of philosophy which is characterized by system building. Nietzsche literally uses the term flying here. Wisdom flies toward the ultimate goal by means of illogical generalizing. And that is often the exact same language and the exact same metaphor that he uses to describe the philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks. So already we have a tension between wisdom and science, and that the scientific spirit has as one of its constitutive elements the commitment to logic. And on the other hand, wisdom, in this very first aspect of it, has a element of illogical generalizing. And illogical generalizing, I think, is best exemplified in that drive to articulate the unity of existence as we find it in the pre-Platonic philosophers. If we consider what Nietzsche said in the passage on Thales in the essay Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks, this is what Nietzsche writes in section 3, quote, "The philosopher tries to make the total chord of the universe re-echo within himself and then to project it into ideas outside himself. He still retains the circumspection to contemplate himself coldly as the reflex of the world. He retains that cool-headedness which the dramatic artist possesses when he transforms himself into other bodies, speaks out of them, and yet knows how to project this transformation outside himself into written verses. What the verse is to the poet, dialectic thinking is to the philosopher. He snatches at it in order to hold fast his enchantment, in order to petrify it." End quote. Thales certainly made an illogical generalization when he said that all is water, just as Heraclitus did when he described existence as an ever-living fire. Notice that Nietzsche refers here to the dramatic artist, the pre-Platonic philosopher, in his flying leap toward his ultimate goal, which is to describe the unity of existence, reflects everything in the cosmos out of the mirror of his own soul. This is more akin to an artistic project than a scientific one. So continuing in the same passage, quote, "Through thus selecting and precipitating the unusual, astounding, difficult, and divine, philosophy marks the boundary lines dividing her from science in the same way as she does from prudence by emphasizing of the useless. Science, without thus selecting, without such delicate taste, pounces upon everything knowable in the blind covetousness to know all at any price." End quote. So it's worth bringing to mind here that the knowledge held by the philosopher is, as we render it in English, his wisdom, but the word that they used in ancient Greece, as Nietzsche points out in his lectures in the Pre-Platonics, was useless. That was how the philosopher's wisdom was regarded by the average Hellene, which means wisdom is imprudent, it's not practical, and it's distinguished from science in this way by the very fact that wisdom is not as good at making distinctions as science is. It is more generalizing. We could say that in both of these faculties of wisdom and science, what Nietzsche is describing here could be classed under what we might call a drive to knowledge. A drive to knowledge definitely exists within these wise men, these pre-Platonic sages. But science is distinguished from wisdom as a drive to knowledge because it's ever concerned with the pragmatic and the practical, with the application of knowledge to craft and technique. Science, we might say, is delicate in its tastes. It specializes, it adjusts its vision down to the level of the smallest nuances, the smallest distinctions. Whereas wisdom is concerned with, quote, the unusual, astounding, difficult, and divine, end quote. And so wisdom, we might say, is a drive to knowledge that is not focused on any one specific aspect of existence, no one domain of existence. Wisdom is not characterized by any specialized field of knowledge about existence. Wisdom is a drive to knowledge about existence as such, the knowledge of which is rare, useless to most, absurd to the scientific logical mind whenever wisdom goes off on its illogical, generalizing flights of fancy. And since that kind of knowledge necessarily exists beyond the limitations of the scientific spirit, it allows itself the kind of artistic means of the illogical generalization. The entire project of naming the arche, the origin, the beginning of things, this project always partakes of such illogical generalizations. This kind of drive is always accompanied by the assessment of a very high value placed on one's own soul, as Nietzsche puts it, that one has a kind of self-legislatory faith in their own inner artistic mirror, so to speak, that one even dares to reflect the totality, the unity of existence in their own poetic language. That speaks to a sort of incredible pride. And as I mentioned at the end of the last episode, pride is one of the recurring themes when we look at the personalities of the pre-Platonics. That pride is what allows them to let their drive of wisdom play freely and recast the entire world of phenomena in their own image, effectively. So why is such a thing valuable to Nietzsche? Well, yet again, it's because of, quote, the relation of these results to life, end quote. For example, when Nietzsche is assessing the philosophical project of Anaximander, who creates this moral picture of existence in which all incarnate beings steal their existence from the indefinite origin of all being, Nietzsche says, quote, it may not be very logical, it is, however, at any rate very human, and moreover quite in harmony with the philosophical leaping described above, end quote. So the wisdom of Anaximander is not in its essence logical so much as it is an image of existence that has profound implications for life. What is relevant is the way in which this reflection of reality motivates our activity. If we are to regard our existence as blameworthy, a theft from the indefinite that must be recompensed with our own destruction, what impact does such a view have on our lives? If we're to regard existence as a mere play of the godchild Aeon, as Heraclitus does, what impact does that view have on our lives? Both these men produce these images out of that unconditional importance that they attach to their own souls. Perhaps the most puzzling line in the bit on wisdom is when Nietzsche says that, quote, one thing is necessary, end quote. And that line could mean many things. I interpret Nietzsche here as saying that this pride, this unconditional importance, is the thing that's necessary for the pursuit of wisdom. This is required because as we're going beyond the limitations of universal objective scientific fact, you have to operate to some extent on faith and on aesthetic taste. And in order to do this, you have to have an almost inflexible trust in yourself. We can see in this picture of both science and wisdom that neither alone can be the sole drive behind philosophy. Rather, in the pre-Platonics, both of these interact in that productive tension. And that's what produces the creative philosophical drive. One must possess a logical mind, but also a willingness to leap illogically in order to fly to their ultimate goal. One must be able to subdue their egoism in service of scientific investigation, but one must also possess the kind of egoism that gives one license to produce such a fanciful, all-encompassing image of reality. Back to the fragment, in the section that immediately follows, Nietzsche describes how Socrates, like all these other pre-Platonic figures, philosophizes out of this tension between wisdom and science. But here, as elsewhere, the theoretical worldview of Socrates threatens to put an end to that productive tension. Nietzsche writes, quote, "Socratism is once wisdom in taking the soul seriously, secondly, science as fear and hatred of illogical generalization, thirdly, something peculiar through the demand of conscious and logically correct action. This causes damage to science, to ethical life. Socrates, just to confess it frankly, is so close to me that almost always I fight a fight against him." End quote. You probably recognize that last line if you've listened to the show for a while. I've quoted that line many times when describing the relationship between Socrates and Nietzsche. This is where that line comes from. It's particularly fascinating to consider that line in light of what immediately precedes it, though. The way in which Socrates, through his very project of attempting to bring forth the scientific and the ethical in their totalizing form, ends up doing harm to both. How does he do harm to both? Well, by disturbing that tension. The wisdom of Socrates is that he takes his soul seriously. The state of one's soul, of one's character, especially their moral character, is one of the most serious concerns in the Socratic worldview. But because he draws upon the scientific distrust of illogical generalization, in other words, against those artistic flights of fancy that are a key part of wisdom, he undercuts his own wisdom by that same token. He emphasizes one aspect of wisdom that ends up being hostile to science, and he ends up emphasizing one aspect of science which is hostile to wisdom. It's another way that you could look at it. And I think Nietzsche sees the way in which he himself could very well end up as a figure just like Socrates, because he sees some of those same tendencies in himself. Perhaps Nietzsche fears endangering the very values that he wished to foster. That's another potential meaning of that last line. Nietzsche writes that Socrates overturns the entire project of the pre-Platonic philosophy, quote, "at a moment when it had just come closest to the truth. This is particularly ironic," end quote. So Nietzsche argues that before the project of philosophy began in the Tragic Age, everything in the Greek world was painted over with myth and allegory. It was only when myth faltered that the spirit of the Greeks could truly shine. At least in this fragment, Nietzsche favorably compares the unallegorical knowledge of the philosophers with the mythic pagan culture of the Greeks, which he calls gloomy. The philosophers were those who dared to deprive themselves of these myths. Quote, "the individual who wants to stand on his own, there he needs final knowledge, philosophy. The other people need slowly growing science," end quote. So the decline and overall demystification of the Greek religion was this steady process. And so for the great many, in the background of that process is a steadily growing scientific mindset as a sort of compensation. And the philosopher is the kind of person who's not satisfied with this. He can see the sublation happening, see the way in which one worldview is overcoming another, and perhaps the very perception of that relativity is something that would then give him license to seek for a firmer foundation on his own. In the same way that you look at the mass of public opinions and how there's no consensus between them, only an endless quarrel, and it drives you to find something on which you can stand firm. Nietzsche writes, quote, "the myth as a lazy bed of thinking, on the other hand, the cold abstraction and the strict science, i.e. Democritus," end quote. So sort of somewhat a negative view of the pure myth and the pure science. Which is interesting because Nietzsche, you could take that as negative in its tone, and it seems like it is. In other passages, Nietzsche seems to really have a great admiration for the Greek mythic culture, and he definitely seems to have a great admiration for Democritus. So, somewhat fascinating. Again, perhaps he realizes the ways in which the tension is slackened maybe at either of those extremes. And so the philosopher steps out of his time, so to speak. He steps away from that entire process, that entire dialectic. He abandons the myth without embracing that purely scientific mindset. Otherwise, he would simply become another scientist, somebody without a desire to represent the whole of reality, which would be recognized by the pure scientist as an illogical project. Science discovers only particular facts via empirical methods, whereas the philosopher's wisdom, on the other hand, is part and parcel with the irrational and the artistic, which are elements needed in reaching his final knowledge, his image of existence. And so, I'm recapitulating for all of this just to say that Socrates, like all these other pre-Platonics, is also like this. It's simply that his irrational act of world creation, the unity of existence that he presents, is the rational world, the intelligible world of the forms, logical categories of existence, their highest being the good. That's the world that Socrates creates. It is like all the other world pictures of the pre-Platonics, an artistic creation. Socrates perceives that man must either perish or become absurdly rational, as Nietzsche puts it in Birth of Tragedy. And so the absurdity, the illogic, and his whole image of the world as strictly intelligible, and the world of the senses as merely the delusion of the masses, that world is the work of Socrates' wisdom. It's a use of the philosophical wisdom that proves dangerous to society. And in fact, Nietzsche sees how the entire project of Greek philosophy shows what a dangerous force philosophy can be. Socrates is not excluded from any of this. In some ways, he's the extreme of that example by creating this logical worldview. But he does so not as part of that steady march of science overcoming myth. He does it by an untimely, illogical generalization, quite frankly. The illogical generalization that the entire world is logical and intelligible. Further down in the fragment, Nietzsche writes, quote, "The older Greekism revealed its powers in the series of philosophers. With Socrates, the revelation breaks off. He tries to generate himself and to reject all tradition. My general task, to show how life, philosophy, and art can have a deeper kinship relationship without philosophy being shallow and the life of the philosopher becoming mendacious. It is marvelous that the ancient philosophers could live so freely without becoming fools and virtuosos. The freedom of the individual was immeasurable." End quote. So once again, there's a centrality of that, the relationship of tension between these different domains, and Nietzsche posing the question to himself, how that relationship can serve life. Philosophy and art placed into a kinship relation. And again, that indicates a relationship of rivalry or mutual struggle, not a sedate sort of kinship. It might be helpful to employ the language used in Homer's Contest to understand maybe one of the key differences between a productive and an unproductive struggle. A Wettkampf means literally a betting competition. This is usually translated at simply as competition or contest. It's the word used in the title of Homer's Contest. And it signifies the agonistic competition between friends with a nevertheless sort of loving and fraternal relationship that undergirds that competition. That is distinguished from the Vernichtungskampf, which we could call a total war or desire to wipe the enemy from the earth. It literally means a war of extermination. So productive relationships of tension would be in the category of a Wettkampf. If it turns into a Vernichtungskampf, the likelihood that the balance between those two forces will be upset or that one will be completely destroyed by the other becomes extremely high, because then that's what their aim is, to destroy one another. The problem with Socrates is that he wages a Vernichtungskampf of science against art, science against wisdom, science against culture, science against the state. All must be suppressed, subordinated, or uprooted. So what was before a productive competition between these domains of human thought or activity becomes a war of extermination. And that's what overturns the entire productive project of the tragic philosophers and initiates that conflict between the theoretic and the tragic. The artistic Socrates that Nietzsche hypothetically puts forward in Birth of Tragedy would be a Socrates who instead continues to play at the Wettkampf, more of a brotherly rivalry between the theoretic and tragic. Quote, "In the whole world, gradualness prevails. With the Greeks, it goes fast forward, thus also terribly fast downward. When the Hellenic genius had exhausted its highest types, the Greek sank the fastest. Only once an interruption had to occur, and the great form of life could no longer be filled. Immediately it was over, just as in tragedy. A single powerful crosshead like Socrates, there the rupture was incurable. In him, the self-destruction of the Greeks takes place. I think it makes sense that he was the son of a sculptor. If once these fine arts could talk, they would appear to us superficial. In Socrates, the son of the sculptor, superficiality came out." End quote. So sculpting is an Apollinean art form. In some sense, it's the ultimate Apollinean art form. It's pure representation, and representation not in the form of lyrical verse, which may require some of your own imagination, nor is it in two-dimensional painting, which does not fully bring a figure into reality. Sculpting brings a physical three-dimensional form into existence. And in a way, it's more real than the real, because unlike living beings, the sculpted form endures as a fixed shape held fast in time that remains ever the same across generations. Socrates is the son of a sculptor, and if an avatar of the art of sculpting could talk and think, he would say the things that Socrates said. Life is only an underlying form. It is only the categories and grammatical rules of thought. It is only coherence, its persistence, stasis of a fixed image, in which every representation is captured and held fast by the mind. This is superficial. It's not actually depth of thought. To make rational thought the unity of existence, as Socrates does. And that's because the ego consciousness is only the surface and skin of our being, in Nietzsche's view. True depth would be to come to an understanding of life that takes account for the irrational, the natural, and the instinctive. So I think it's actually a rather brilliant passage to tie the problem of Socrates to the fact that he's the son of a sculptor, which I don't think Nietzsche makes that critique anywhere else in his work. Quote, "The Greeks were with Empedocles and Democritus on the best way to correctly assess the human existence, its unreasonableness, its suffering. They never got to that, thanks to Socrates. The unbiased view of human beings is missing in all Socratics, who have ghastly abstracts, the good, the just, in their heads. They lose impartiality through Socrates. The myths and tragedies of the Greeks are much wiser than the ethics of Plato and Aristotle, and their Stoic and Epicurean men are poor against their older poets and statesmen." End quote. And so here, Nietzsche says that Democritus and Empedocles, they were guiding the Greeks on the best way to correctly assess human existence. And it's interesting because just earlier in the fragment, he seems to associate Democritus with a sort of purely scientific, materialistic worldview, which he calls cold and calculating, which, as I said, when we looked at that passage, could come off as somewhat negative. But, you know, and I think a lot of this, some of those apparent contradictions might just be in the fact these are roughly sketched out notes and we can't really demand absolute consistency from them. But I think Nietzsche makes it clear here, these latter figures of the pre-Platonic philosophers were guiding the Greeks on the best possible path to assess human existence. And he calls it correct here, you know, hearkening back to his lecture on Democritus, where he says the Democritean system is the most consequential of all of the ancient systems of thought. And the reason why the Socratic philosophy is a step down is also interesting, that it's a loss of impartiality, that there was a kind of, what might we say, an almost wise detachment or wise form of dispassion in Democritus, in contrast to Socrates's somewhat unwise form of scientific hostility toward the illogical generalization, we might say. And it's not exactly easy for me to find the words for why one form of detachment or dispassionate approach is wise and the other is not, except to say that, Nietzsche makes it clear here that really it's the moralism of the Socratics, which seems to be relatively absent from somebody like Democritus. Now, another helpful segment that Nietzsche arranges in a list form gives a contrast between the older Greekism, which we've identified with the tragic age, the age of the pre-Platonic philosophers, and the younger Greekism, which he characterizes here with the title of Socratism, which is what we might call the Greekism of Hellenistic Greece, or as Nietzsche calls it in Birth of Tragedy, Alexandrian Greece. The older Greekism is the productive tension between wisdom and science. The newer is characterized by the unbalanced, superficial tyranny of scientism that's inaugurated by Socrates. And so here are the ways in which the older Greekism is different from the newer. Quote, 1. The older one is related to art. Its solution of the world riddle has been inspired several times by art. 2. It is not the negation of the other life, but has grown out of it as a rare blossom. It speaks its secrets, theory, practice. 3. It is not so individual, eudaimonological, without the nasty pretension to happiness. 4. These older philosophers themselves have in their lives higher wisdom, and not the cold, clever virtuousness. Their life picture is richer and more complicated. The Socratics simplify and trivialize. End quote. There's another running theme that I haven't drawn out yet, but that you might have noticed, of Nietzsche discussing virtue itself as a sort of superficial thing. When he talks about philosophers, the danger of them becoming mendacious, becoming virtuosos or fools. That moralism is an inherently public thing. It's an inherently surface-level thing that, in a way, is the farthest thing from the kinds of depths of the soul in which one discovers one's wisdom, the way Nietzsche is using it here. That morality, that pursuit, which is characterized so much of philosophical writing, is in some very profound sense for Nietzsche not what philosophy is truly about. Now, we may recall in the essay Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks the ways in which the pre-Platonic philosopher in Nietzsche's characterization draws on the powers of art, the power of science, the power of religion. All of those elements are required, but no one element is the definitive aspect of philosophy, because that form of philosophy, the practice of philosophy that comes out of the older Greekism, is not interested in simplifying life, reducing it down to one of those aspects, one of those approaches. The way that, for example, Socratism is interested in doing with science, with the theoretical approach to life. The pre-Platonics, on the other hand, are these rich, complex characters, characters in whom multiple opposing drives walked under one yoke, as Nietzsche puts it. So the fact that they all produce an image of a unity of existence, I think, gives us the best articulation of Nietzsche's conception of making two opposing drives walk under one yoke, or, as he would later talk about it, giving style to one's character, or of being a commander and self-legislator, to organize and direct one's competing drives or impulses, which necessarily means to harness the tension between them toward a definite end, whatever the ultimate goal of one's knowledge might be. These figures are tragic. They don't come with the pretension that their ideas are a way to the happy life either, or to the idealized society. That's what Nietzsche, I think, invents a word here, eudaimonological, the study of eudaimonia, right? The study of how do we achieve the good life or the happy life. These figures are not concerned with that so much as Socrates is. We could say that in a way, that question is the central driving question behind all moralism and all philosophy in pursuit of that moralism. But it doesn't characterize this earlier form of philosophy. And so they draw upon art, they draw upon wisdom, they don't just draw upon science, and they don't stand in negation to the way of life that births them. That's another key point. The philosophers of the tragic age don't emerge in order to wage war against the tragic age, or against the unallegorical, unmythological philosophers don't emerge to make war on the Greek myths, and to make war on the use of these allegories for explaining life. In fact, they sometimes use those allegories to make their point. I think a lot of what we're discussing here really becomes clear in a figure like Empedocles, where Nietzsche sees how science and myth are both two different kinds of horses. Scientific thinking and mythic thinking are two different kinds of horses one might ride to their goal, but we might see them as fundamentally horses of a different temperament, right? Or horses who want to run in two different ways, and he sort of harnesses them together and rides either or at a given time according to his need. He makes these two competing drives sort of walk under one yoke, so to speak, and he's a character that blends all of these sort of different, apparently contradictory character aspects, and he utilizes and draws upon the personified deities of Aphrodite or Harmonia, however she's called, as this this force of love, this to use it to describe something which is actually philosophically fecund. So I think Empedocles is a wonderful example of much of what Nietzsche's talking about. And I should say, there's a great deal about Greek history in this fragment as well, where Nietzsche speculates about various figures throughout Greek history, not all of whom are philosophers. And he kind of speculates about the driving motivations behind several key figures in Greek history, or speculates about the effect that certain events had on the course of Greek history. Again, much of this is not arranged in a coherent chronological way. These remarks are somewhat scattered throughout the fragment. But there are a few interpretive claims that Nietzsche makes that may interest us in light of our inquiry into productive tensions, which I guess is the theme here. So, for one thing, Nietzsche brings to mind the Greek king hatred, which he called their abomination of autocracy in Homer's Contest. Part of the reason why Nietzsche marvels at the freedom by which the philosophers lived is that one could arguably interpret Nietzsche as holding the belief that the Greeks needed the aegon as a restraining mechanism in their society, first and foremost, that the ongoing mutual competition strengthened them all, but also moderated them all. They all served as checks on one another because they were such impulsive, passionate people. And without such checks, they would have lunged headlong into the abysses of cruelty, the most horrific excesses. And so Nietzsche writes, quote, "The tyrant who can do whatever he wants, i.e. the Greek who is not restrained by any force, is a completely self-indulgent being. He overthrows the customs of the fatherland, does violence to women, and kills people at will. Equally unbridled is the tyrannical free spirit, of whom the Greeks are also afraid." End quote. So this hatred of autocracy is a sign of the democratic spirit of the Greeks, and accordingly Nietzsche thinks that the reforms that many attempted to implement in the Greek world might actually have been possible had the tyrant been an Empedocles. Empedocles, he was, of course, a man who was democratic in his sentiments, and he was also a Pythagorean religious reformer. And, you know, he wished to bring all of the Hellenic world into the spirit of brotherly love. But instead, the tyrannies never lasted, and the spirit of religious reform which characterizes the 6th century BC, fizzled out, and the religion continued to degenerate in Nietzsche's interpretation, which allowed Socratism to later come along and then flourish. Perhaps surprisingly, though, Nietzsche's not writing negatively about democracy in this passage. The mutual check on power might be one of its advantages, assuming, of course, that the people in question are the extraordinary Greeks. They are the ones who are mutually checking each other's power. I guess you could say that part of Nietzsche's problem with modern democracy is the superficiality and small-mindedness of the average person, in his view. And so, of course, the extraordinary Greeks would be able to overcome that problem. Interestingly, Nietzsche treats the Peloponnesian War as a tragic event in this text. He writes, quote, "How terrible it was that the battle had to break out between Athens and Sparta. This cannot be considered deep enough," end quote. As for why Nietzsche writes this, I think we could compare the situation to the Franco-Prussian War and Nietzsche's interpretation of that struggle between two nations of his time. The Germans had once held the greatest artistic and cultural capital in the European world. Throughout the 1700s, the Germans were the preeminent artists and musicians and poets, and the France of the 1700s, meanwhile, eventually produces the French Revolution, Napoleon, and the Napoleonic Wars. The French become a people of martial quality. By the time of the Franco-Prussian War, however, Germany had lost its cultural capital and become a martial people. The roles sort of began to reverse. Accordingly, Nietzsche always writes of the German culture as a motley collection of foreign customs and improperly integrated past achievements. He says that the Germans of his day belong to the past and to the distant future, but in the present day they are complete cultural barbarians. Nietzsche remarks that it is as if the Germans are spending all of their societal energy now on militarism and have abandoned culture. And so that's perhaps why Nietzsche sees a tension between culture and the state in the first place, because he perceived that tension in Germany. So by the time the Germans handily defeat the French in the Franco-Prussian War, the French have become by far a more culturally rich people. And so the reason for going into all of this is because there's perhaps a parallel that can be found in Athens and Sparta, again, from Nietzsche's point of view. The Athenians, Nietzsche argues, were not really the cultural apex of Greek society, as they're often said to be. Nietzsche writes, quote, "Just think how unproductive Athens was for philosophy for a long time. Pindar would not have been possible as an Athenian. Simonides shows it. Nor would Empedocles have been, nor Heraclitus. All the great musicians come from outside. Athenian tragedy is not the highest form one could think of. The heroes of it lack the Pindarian too much." End quote. So, if you noticed when we were going over the pre-Platonic Greeks in the past handful of episodes, the number of them that come from Athens are, zero. It's not until we get to Socrates that we have a natural-born Athenian philosopher of any note, and though several of them do move to Athens, none of them are from Athens. And here, Nietzsche unfavorably compares Simonides to Pindar, those two great rivals of one another. But instead, the real genius of the Athenians in their earlier period, the period of older Greece, was in producing statesmen, producing sailors and strategoi. The Athenians grew to a position of domination over the Greek society through the Delian League as undisputed masters of the sea, not as the sort of cultural zenith of Greek society. Quote, "The spiritual domination of Athens was the prevention of that reformation. It is necessary to think about the time when this domination did not exist. It was not necessary. It became necessary only as a result of the Persian Wars, that is, only after it showed the physical political power. Miletus, for example, was much more talented. Agrigentum, too." End quote. So Miletus is a city that produces two, or possibly three, of those philosophers of the Tragic Age, Thales, Anaximander, and possibly Democritus. Agrigentum is where Empedocles is from. When Sparta defeats Athens in the Peloponnesian War with the help of the Persians, the Athenians lose their militarist capital and instead focus solely on their cultural capital. But given how Nietzsche assesses the Athenian culture up to that point, he thinks that's a kind of disaster, especially because immediately after the period of the oligarchic domination of Athens, following their loss to Sparta, what happens next? Well, the age of Socratism. This is the Athens that culturally dominates Greece, the Athens of Socrates and Plato and the Academy. And so Nietzsche here prefigures his comments from the preface of Beyond Good and Evil, when he suggests the reason why Plato could not fulfill the role of reformer and redeemer of Athenian society is because he was, quote, distracted by Socrates, end quote. And he writes a sentence that hints to us not of a complete thought of Nietzsche's, but an unfinished project. The sentence, quote, attempt to characterize Plato without Socrates, end quote. And unfortunately, I don't think he ever really developed this idea, since I don't recall ever coming across such an attempt in Nietzsche's work. But that's all to say, this harkens to mind that Nietzschean musing that perhaps Plato is corrupted by Socrates after all, or as he puts it here, distracted by Socrates. Following this section of the fragment, Nietzsche once again lists off the eight main figures of pre-Platonic philosophy. But first, he brings up Mimnermus and Pindar, two poets, to describe the sort of poetic, tragic spirit of the Hellenic world, we might say the soil out of which these philosophers grew. And what follows is a sort of timeline of how the struggles between these forces unfolded. It's Nietzsche's interpretation of the whole story of the Tragic Age of the Greeks in the form of a bullet-pointed list, which is actually very helpful, even though it's just sort of a rough sketch. Quote, the passion in Mimnermus, the hatred against the age, the deep melancholy in Pindar. Only when a ray comes from above, human life shines. To understand the world from suffering is the tragic in tragedy. Thales, the unmythical, Anaximander, passing and arising in nature morally as guilt and punishment. Heraclitus, lawfulness and justice in the world. Parmenides, the other world behind this one as a problem. Anaxagoras, world builder. Empedocles, blind love and blind hate, the deep unreasonable and the most reasonable of the world. Democritus, the world is completely without reason and drive poured together, all gods and myths useless. Socrates, there remains nothing but I myself. Fear for oneself becomes the soul of philosophy. Plato's attempt to think everything to the end and to be the redeemer, end quote. So these relations of tension are perceptible in various places in this story. We can see in Thales, myth defeated by wisdom. In Parmenides, the senses in tension with logic. In Empedocles, we have the illogical generalizations of wisdom, placed within a scientific, reasonable mind. In Democritus, we have the most rigorous necessity ruling over the world, but with none of the teleology of Socrates or the moral order suggested by Anaximander. In Democritus, we have perhaps the greatest heightening of that tension so far, the most consequential expression of a world image, illogical, but in how it dares to encompass the whole world within this atomistic reality governed by chance, but scientific nevertheless in its commitment to logic and the most disciplined in its economy of principles. Nietzsche explains this in another fragmentary note. This one is from 2 years prior in 1873, and this is for his notes for the continuation of philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks, as that essay was never finished. It goes unfinished before it reaches Empedocles and Democritus. In the first section of that note, Nietzsche writes, quote, "That hypothesis, which explains the existing world with the smallest expenditure of assumptions and means, is to have preference. For in such a hypothesis is to be found the least amount of arbitrariness, and in it free play with possibilities is prohibited. Should there be two hypotheses which both explain the world, then a strict test must be applied as to which of the two better satisfies that demand of economy. He who can manage this explanation with the simpler and more known forces, especially the mechanical ones, he who deduces the existing edifice of the world out of the smallest possible number of forces, will always be preferred to him who allows the more complicated and less known forces, and these moreover in greater number, to carry on the world-creating play." End quote. So my reading of this is that Democritus is the height of this productive tension. Nietzsche says in that same note when describing Democritus that he gives us, quote, "the greatest possible simplification of the hypotheses," end quote. So he's supremely scientific in this way. And yet this is not a scientific drive of the same kind of that of Socrates that overthrows wisdom and indeed overthrows or attacks all other possible domains of human thought and activity. Democritus makes the illogical generalization, the flight of fancy necessary to, quote, "carry on a world-creating play," end quote, but he does so with the greatest economy of forces. In the wake of this, Nietzsche's description of Socrates is perhaps one of the most biting in Nietzsche's entire corpus, when, as far as the criticisms of Socrates go. The fact that his philosophy expresses a fear for oneself, that's basically how he describes Socrates in the list we just looked at, that all that remains for you to hold on to in this meaningless, unteleological world of matter is your own self. But the self in what sense? It cannot be the body, the fleeting physical form. That would be a terrifying thought. And so it becomes one's character, one's soul. That's what becomes the thing of the highest value for Socrates. And so the implication here is that the Socratic moral obsession comes out of a fear for how to preserve one's soul somehow. Perhaps it can be done through right and virtuous action. And Plato, as a systematizer, consequently cannot redeem the Greek culture because that moral idea of Socrates infects his system building. It distracts and possesses him. As Nietzsche says earlier in the note, Socrates is the tragic end of tragedy itself. But this downfall for the Hellenic tragic culture by no means sours Nietzsche against it. He writes in one of the last paragraphs of this fragment, which I will quote in full, quote, "I am therefore not weary of placing before my soul a number of thinkers, each of whom had that incomprehensibility about him, and must arouse that wonderment how he found his very possibility of life. The thinkers who lived in the most vigorous and fertile period of Greece, and the century before and during the Persian Wars. For these thinkers discovered beautiful possibilities of life, and it seems to me that the later Greeks have forgotten the best of them. And what nation could say until now that it has rediscovered them? Compare the thinkers of other times and other peoples with the series of figures that begins with Thales and ends with Democritus. Nay, place Socrates and his disciples and all the sectarian heads of later Greece beside those ancient Greeks. I see no distorted and desolate figures among them, no penny-pinching faces, no fleshed-out desert hermits, no fanatic whitewashers of present things, no theologizing falsifiers, no depressed and pale scholars. Although the germs are there for all of this, only an evil breeze needs to come over it, and all the weeds are in bloom. I also do not see those among them who take as so important the salvation of their soul, or the question, what is happiness? That they forget the world and the people in it. Who could rediscover these possibilities for life? Poets and historians should brood over this task, because such people are too rare. Rather, one should not give oneself rest until he has recreated their pictures and painted them 100 times on the wall. For our so inventive time still lacks just that marvelous beauty, wherefrom our ugliness? For what is beauty if not the reflection beheld by us of an extraordinary joy of nature at the discovery of a new fruitful possibility of life? And what is ugliness if not the displeasure about itself, the doubt whether it really still understands the art to seduce life? End quote. The final question reminds us again what this is all about for Nietzsche. Just as the battling forces of science and wisdom that drove the pre-Platonic project had as their common yoke the desire to relate one's ultimate and most highly prized knowledge to the activity of life, right? To render this unity of existence, but to do so out of a unabashed faith in one's own soul, and in order to produce something which has relevance for life. Nietzsche sees the battling forces of Socratism and the older Greekism as something that the modern person can use for the same purpose. The study of these pre-Platonic figures is first and foremost a seduction to life, because their thought and their character somehow suggests a marvelous beauty to us even across the centuries and millennia. Studying such beautiful possibilities for life is not so much about the desire to become absorbed with any one of these great figures and become a mere emulator, but rather to see the beautiful tension between them, the way that they sharpen one another in their struggles to make their own individual world images reign supreme. We see this, for example, in the contrast Nietzsche creates between Heraclitus and Parmenides. It's through both of them, this mutual opposition and hostility, that we see both figures all the more clearly. And it's worth noting that this alleged hostility between these two is at best a great embellishment of Nietzsche's. It's his own retrospective interpretation of how the two relate. But that reveals something very valuable about the undercurrents of Nietzsche's thought, and how his examination of the tragic era philosophers and the Socratics who came after them has a far-reaching significance for him. The entirety of Nietzsche's philosophical thought begins on the heels of these considerations of mutual relations of tension, the health or sickness of a society as measured in whether such relations are productive or not. While later Nietzsche would move on from culture as a central focus, and would move on also from the aesthetic justification for life, questions such as the problem of science, or the role of philosopher to culture, the relationship of art to rational thought, these would always preoccupy him. He finds in the Greeks and their cultural history a relevant and eternally instructive example to us in the modern day, all the way through to one of his last books, The Twilight of Idols. He returns to the problem of Socrates there, and he ruminates about the future of European culture. As Nietzsche remarks at the conclusion of this 1875 fragment, quote, "The Greeks have certainly never been overestimated," end quote. We have never come close to really grasping just how important the story of the Hellenic world truly is. For Nietzsche, all of the drama that now unfolds in the arenas of modern culture is already there in the story of Greece. That's all for this week, everyone. I love getting into more obscure material like this. I also want to suggest that if you're interested in reading more about this, go check out Joel Zwan's thesis, The Struggle Between Science and Wisdom in Nietzsche's Early Writings. When I set out to analyze this fragment, and I went and reread the fragment, and then I went and I read the note for continuation of Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks, and then I just recently reread a couple of the Untimely Meditations, and I was trying to organize my thoughts on all of this, and I found Zwan's thesis, and it was a very helpful source, mainly, once again, for pointing me to a couple of citations in Nietzsche's work, he got me thinking about relations of tension, which is a phrasing that Deleuze used in Nietzsche and philosophy. Deleuze was also a very helpful influence on interpreting this as well. Next week, I'm going to talk about another one of Nietzsche's interpreters beyond Deleuze, though. This time it's going to be somebody who's much more critical of Nietzsche. In fact, it's one of the most serious challenges to Nietzsche's entire project. So join me next week when we take a look at an essay by René Girard and discuss Girard's criticism of Nietzsche. Hope to see you then. Signing off. If you enjoyed the Nietzsche podcast or found it helpful, you can visit us and support the show at patreon.com/untimelyreflections. The link is in the description. Or just share the show with any of your friends that you think might enjoy it or on social media. Thank you for your support.